and let us know how you could help. Again, please call us at 347-647-WBAI or 347-335-0008 or email us at wbai.pacifica@gmail.com. Together, we will win.
We did it before, we'll do it again.
Do you want your favorite WBAI programming to continue to air without the Fun Drive Day preemption? Becoming a BAI buddy is a great way to prevent that and to help support the station. Just by going to give to WBAI.org, you can donate today. So before you decide to buy that electronic accessory for your smartphone, here are some more fulfilling ways to use that money with some perks. You can use your WBAI membership card and receive discounts on Zipcar, 2 for the price of 1 admission at the Museum of the City of New York, 20% off sessions with life and career coach Nina Della Vecchia, and much more. You will also receive a WBAI tote bag, which you can use to carry around some on-air giveaways. For more information, go to give2, that's the number 2, WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Randy Credico, host of Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on WBAI Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Hey, did you know you can actually donate to WBAI via text message? That's right, for as little as $10. Just text the letters WBAI to the number 41444. Keep the vision of Lewis Hill alive. Join the WBAI $10 text team. Text WBAI to the number 41444. That's all, folks.
Is this where I sign up to get my medical oregano?
You don't have to sign up for medical oregano.
I don't need a medical oregano card.
The medicinal properties of oregano are well known.
I know. I heard it on WBAI.
Even so, my brother was unable to speak, could not walk. We gave him oregano.
And it cured him?
First he started to crawl.
Oh.
Then he sort of toddled.
Could he say anything?
He said da-da.
Oh.
Then mama. And then he went off to kindergarten.
And you owe it all to oregano.
No, we owe it all to WBAI.
Well, what about the oregano?
We put it on his pizza.
If you owe it all to WBAI, make sure to keep your membership current. For only $25 a year, you will enjoy all the privileges of membership, including the right to vote in WBAI's democratically run elections. And don't forget to sprinkle some oregano on your pizza.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund, and wow, 3 weeks in a row during a fundraising drive I am put on the air. I'm very, very pleased by that, and I hope that you'll be pleased enough to help donate at a certain point. On the agenda this morning, well, another freeform show, but what we will do is go through the years of Hour of the Wolf to an extent. Stay tuned. We're starting with the movie review.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. There is a sequence in Blade Runner 2049 that is, and I'm not being at all ironic about this, probably the greatest thing I'm going to see all year. It comes after close to 2 hours of watching Ryan Gosling, who plays a replicant, in other words, an artificially engineered human, Blade Runner, in other words, a bounty hunter for other renegade replicants. Do I need to explain these things to this audience? We're watching this replicant Blade Runner named Kay trying to track down a baby that was born to 2 missing replicants, which is a thing that isn't supposed to happen, but apparently has. The trail leads to a former Blade Runner, Rick Deckard, played in this film as he was in the original Blade Runner by Harrison Ford, who may also be a replicant himself, depending on which cut of Blade Runner you've seen, although this sequel lands pretty firmly on Replicant, and who is hiding out in an abandoned casino in a nuclear zone that we presently call Las Vegas. Deckard is a little cautious about Kay's presence, which is the least one can say about someone who pulls a gun on you, and the upshot is that Kay and Deckard maneuver each other into a fistfight in a malfunctioning holographic showroom where projected versions of Elvis, Marilyn, and a bevy of showgirls sputter randomly to life on various platforms in the darkened room while a deafening soundtrack cuts in and out at the most disconcerting moments. It is, unambiguously, a fantastic bit of filmmaking using action, editing, lighting, audio, and special effects to create something surreal, disturbing, exciting, and weirdly funny. It is also, as I noted, something that comes after close to 2 hours of sitting through a film that alternates between similar stunning moments. It is inarguable that director Denis Villeneuve brings a lot of visual flair to SF, as he demonstrated with his previous film Arrival. Dubious plot points, Hampton Fancher, writer of the first film, has seen fit here to retcon in the replicants, or at least one replicant's ability to procreate, and provide a new, and for me, unacceptable reason why Deckard met the replicant Rachel in the first film, and bits of business that pad out a film that, at 2 hours and 44 minutes with credits, doesn't really need padding. I don't know why we need to spend 15 seconds watching a guy flip through an old book, but we do. Doesn't seem like a lot of time when you say it, but you do feel it, and that kind of stuff adds up after a while. The plus side of keeping your film to 90 minutes, hell, even 70 minutes, is that it forces consistency on you. A good film will likely stay good. A sucky film tends to be reliably sucky throughout. There are moments of supreme beauty and subtle emotion seeded through Blade Runner 2049, an encounter between Kay and a programmer of replicant memories, played with touching fragility by Carla Jury, stands out for me. But there's just too much, too many ravishing establishing shots, too many moments that don't really add to an emotional whole. And for all its action, the finale feels weirdly inert and isn't helped by Ford's blank canvas performance at the end. It was joked that Star Trek the Motion Picture should have been called Star Trek the Motionless Picture because of its emphasis on ambience at the expense of forward momentum. That accusation has also been leveled at the anime sequel Ghost in the Shell Memory for similar reasons. Blade Runner 2049 may well join those films in this dubious fraternity. I notice that reactions of my Facebook friends have run the gamut between orgasmic to you gotta be kidding me. I fall more into the latter camp, but have to admit there was enough amazing stuff within Blade Runner 2049 that I didn't completely regret sinking nearly 3 hours into the experience, and over time I may learn to, at least, better appreciate the film in the same way that I've come to eventually treasure STTMP. Not so much that it's a great film, but that it dared to rise to something great. Your mileage may vary, and this is a case where it's likely you're not going to know until you delve into it yourself. For your sake, I hope you find Blade Runner 2049 a more elevating experience. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And I am given to believe that that MFA is not in fact a degree, but something unrepeatable on the air. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. My name is Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf. And while the official date would have been 6 months ago, approximately, well, May, it was May, we are celebrating this week my 50 years, God help us, working for WBAI. I started at age 13, answering phones and doing the things that, well, a 13-year-old might do. But I was also hanging out with people like Samuel R. Delaney, Barrett Searles, Thomas M. Dish, Joanna Russ, some guy named Theodore Sturgeon, who Barrett Searles was the DNL director, and he brought people together. Now, on Monday from 3 to 5, if I sound distracted very often, I think it's because I am. We're doing this. This is also a video show. You are welcomed to watch this on Facebook. You go to Facebook Live and you look me up. I don't believe that you have to have friended Freund, but if you look up Jim Freund, that's F-R-E-U-N-D, you can probably go there and watch this broadcast at about, 35 to 40 seconds later. Under what show's name was Monday's program archived? No, it's not. It wasn't under Cat Radio Cafe. It's the 2 1-hour programs after that. And no, I do not have any Family Electric Theater air checks available to me. There's a long story about that, and I'll tell that story later. Steve, I already answered your question on Facebook itself. No, I do not have a recording of me talking about Tolkien. But, aha, I brought the Asimov stuff with me, so we may hear some of that this morning. Okay, where was I? Let's roll back. This is posted, set to public, so anyone with access to the internet and Earl can see it. Thank you, Gary. Okay. Ah, ooh, and Jack and Cade has a fandom too. I can see a cool thing about doing the Facebook Live is not just that I get to be on TV in a manner of speaking, but it's that there's a community out there. And and my phone isn't muted. So whenever somebody does something like Tom just did, it makes a noise. So I have to, I sure hope I don't disconnect everything. Let's see. On my past phone, I had it set so that when the radio show started, there we are, it would automatically mute the phone. I have now done it manually. Cool. Okay, very good. So, let's see. Rolling back to whatever it was I was actually talking about. So, on Monday from 3 to 5 p.m., I know I have to say 3 to 5 p.m., should I send you a tweet about the social media? Can we bombard you? Not Friendster. My God, I don't think I was ever on Friendster for more than a moment. No, you can do it on Facebook. Or you can send me an email is another thing people can do. I can actually open up my email while I am here. Dum-dum-dum. Let's see, because I'm already logged in. Please, somebody remind me to log out. There we are. Yes, so people can email me at jfreund@ourwolf.com. But for the duration of this, you can just text me on Facebook or whatever, which is something that I generally prefer not to do. Okay, so anyway, from 3 to 5, and it's in the archives as what, you know, from 3 to 4 p.m., whatever that show was called, and from 4 to 5, whatever that show was called, I will post it under my own name. It's in the Hour of the Wolf group. You're also all welcome to join the Hour of the Wolf group and the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group. That's NYRSF, NYRSF group. And you will see there the links that will let you hear Monday's show. And it was a wonderful show. I have to thank James Ursay for pulling it all together. Only grandpas use email these days. Yep, well, I get over 150 emails a day. So a lot of grandpas out there. And I guess grandmas. And no, they're not all robots. At any rate. And you say current apps? Friendster? No. So, Ursay helped bring together Janet Coleman and David Doza, the first people to actually put me on the air, which I hadn't realized was as late as 1971, which means that from 67 to 71, now I sparsely attended BAI 67-68, but, you know, I was there for all the fundraising drives. I was there for the recording of the Star Pit, which we broadcast a couple of weeks ago, starting at 3 a.m., and all that. But I talked primarily about the years with WBAI itself. What we did not get to talk about too much, and I got a couple of emails about this, was Hour of the Wolf and the history of Hour of the Wolf and the history of science fiction on WBAI. And I have to tell you, I was thinking of not coming in. Daniel, I haven't seen Blade Runner yet. Had you been available on the phone, I thought you said you had to get up in the morning. then I would have made a point of seeing it. I have this idea that you know, one day what I'll do is there's like a 9:15 show at a really wonderful movie theater right near here. You can even get dinner during the movie there. And then I would walk into the station having just seen it, and then I can talk about it. All I can tell you is about Mr. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Denis, I think it is, rather than Dennis, because he is Canadian. Oh, you are going to bed soon. Thank you. And congrats on, well, gee, 50 years ago, you were editing Ciné Fantastique, weren't you? Or at least one of its primary folk. But the Villeneuve... I can tell you that his last film is one of the five best science fiction films to come out this millennium, and that film was Arrival. And how this one is, I cannot say yet. I have questions, since the primary scriptwriter was, again, Hampton Fencher, who I don't think did a very good job with the original Blade Runner. We will do a whole show on Blade Runner. You, Daniel, will be included. So, but I'd like to get some other people involved, if at all possible. So we'll have at least, you know, three folks talking about it, preferably Matt Kressel, who has always been of the opinion that the original Blade Runner is one of the best films ever made. And I'm not so sure about that. I'm really not. So much of that film that is iconic was actually improvised by the actors and all that. And so people saying in retrospect certain things like this person is a replicant, that one isn't, when in fact isn't spelled out, when it's not even purposely left oblique. What it really is, I think, plain old, simple, typical movie carelessness. Okay? And that so many people are saying, well, if this were true, then that wouldn't be true. And if that were true, this weren't true. And it swings both ways. One way or the other, I think it's safe to say that the original Blade Runner movie does not hold together in terms of logic. It certainly isn't really based on Philip K. Dick. It takes a very Dick-like universe, but not the universe of Duandroid's Dream of Electric Sheep. In fact, from what I've heard, this new movie is probably a little closer to it. Yes, Jim. The new movie will be around for at least a couple of weeks. I checked at the movie theater near here, and they said, oh, it's not going anywhere for a while. And indeed, I look at their seating. You can actually book seats in advance, which is one of the things I love. And it has been selling out. They do not, however, have it in 3D. And Dan Persons, if you are still logged into Facebook, was the 3D worth it or not? As far as I'm concerned, I saw, for example, Valerian, a movie that I'm the one who liked it. Actually, Dan liked it too. I saw it both in 2D and in 3D. I saw it in 3D first and then in 2D. And you know what? There were a couple of like, oh, that's cool moments in 3D. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. There are very, very few films that are worth the extra, not only money, but the hassle of wearing the special glasses, because I also wear. Can you all hear that on the air? I know you can see it on Facebook, but I also wear glasses. And it's hard to wear both at the same time. Although the ones they had for Valerian, wherever I saw that, weren't too bad. They weren't too heavy. But the 3D wasn't that special. And I don't know if it will be that special in Blade Runner. Dan, I think you're still logged in. If you hear me, and if you saw it in 3D, just let me know if you think the 3D is worth it. So, anyway, when I see it, I'm going to see it in 2D. Don't matter to me that much. Let's get back to, first of all, since I have told so many stories about Hour of the Wolf and my coming to WBAI on the air so many times, I thought I might open the phones at the top of the show, specifically into questions about my history and the history of BAI. So I didn't get to finish. It was Ursay, David Dozer, Janet Coleman, and then joining us toward the end of the show was Max Schmid. And between the four of us, five of us, I counted that was well over 200 years of WBAI. And one person online remarks, my problem is that Ridley Scott doesn't understand the point of his own film. Oops, it just scrolled off. Deckard can't be a replicant or the film loses all point. But Scott doesn't get this. And then, and now it says see more. But when I click that, all it does is bring up the person. Yeah, and he decided it would be cooler. Yes, Gary, I absolutely, totally agree with what you are saying. That he is... I see. I have to click this thing down. Oh, yeah. And a person on Facebook responds to him, quite right, Gary, but JFC, just look what he's doing to the Alien series. Well, the only person who did anything really good with Alien, as far as I'm concerned, was James Cameron. Well, no. Ridley Scott did a good ghost movie, I have to say that. He did a haunted house, not a ghost movie, but he did a very good haunted house film. Having said that, again, style over substance. Okay, and facing in my argument from that link. Okay. I'm going to have to look at that, I'm afraid, either when I play a tune or when I'm offline. So, as I was saying, if people wish to call up and discuss the years here at WBAI, the telephone number on air is 347-335-0818. And I hope that will come through well enough on the Facebook feed as well. One problem with the Facebook feed was when I got home from the program last week at about 4 a.m., I took a look, and there was a note to me from automated Facebook admin saying that they had detected the song Sails of Silver, which is the outro for my show, and did I own the rights to it? Because if not, it shouldn't be on Facebook. However, they did allow me the option of posting it or not, and I did. Because we, in fact, do pay BMI and ASCAP and Sound Exchange for the rights to broadcast it. But then, if it's background music on Facebook, that's another question. Are more rights there? I got a number of opinions, many of them saying, yes, you do have the rights. Some of them saying... that there was an interesting court case about a woman who was playing with her baby to a tune in the background, and the thing went viral, so she had a court case in which they were going after her for having used the music and posted the music on YouTube. And then there's stuff about the focal point and all that. At any rate, getting back to the Facebook arguments and all that, that's for a future show. Tonight's show is about history of Hour of the Wolf and science fiction radio here at WBAI. So rolling back all the way to science fiction history at BAI, the music director at one Pacifica station. I don't know if it was directly BAI or not, or if it was out of L.A. Somebody like Gary, who is listening. So the question is whether compulsory licenses to BAI, I guess, for music services extend to Facebook. Interesting. Well, yeah, exactly. It is a question whether, you know, the secondary thing. Yeah, it is an interesting legal point. And I would rather not get BAI involved in another legal case again. We just lost a major lawsuit which for back rent at the Empire State Building, which with legal fees amounts to something minimum of $1.8 million, which is why people need to call and pledge. We'll get to that in a while. So, going way, way back, Anthony Boucher worked for Pacifica Radio. He was a music director. He did a show called Golden Voices of Opera. And it was a fun show, half-hour show. I have one tape, or perhaps I had one tape. I had a disaster to much of my tape collection last March when my house suffered a flood in the basement, went 14 inches high, and many, many old tapes were destroyed. And I don't know what's what, because among other things, the very old labels on those tapes simply came off. So even if I can take them, and the insurance company said that they would help pay for recovery, which is a wonderful thing, I don't know what I should have recovered because they ain't labeled. I would love to have, you know, the tape part of my six-hour interview with Roger Zelazny or Clifford D. Simak, but I do not need me taking phone calls at 3 a.m. while zoned out and playing music in the background. That would be a waste of everybody's time and effort. So some of these tapes are problematic. So, nonetheless, I'm sure that Pacifica Archives, which sort of still exists, will have some of Anthony Boucher's tapes, but they're not related to science fiction at all. They're related to music. Nonetheless, for those who knew Anthony Boucher's writing and his editing and his creation with Reginald Bretner under the name Grendel Brierton, they created what were called feghoots. Why has no one in television yet crossed genres and produced an interstellar court show, Law and Order, Milky Way? Well, it depends on the quadrants, but I think that's due, Gary. I really do. So he says on one of the tapes, Strange Voices, that I'm now about to play you recording of a castrato. For those of you who are not aware of what castrati were, a castrato is a man who was cut out to be an opera singer. Not quite a feghoot, but it shows the sense of humor that that he had. And so I certainly count Anthony Boucher's tenure on WBAI as being early involvement with science fiction on this radio station. But it wasn't too far. Doesn't Melinda Snodgrass have several law in outer space novels? She probably does. And in fact, we're friended on Facebook. So if you post it on my page, she may very well see that and be able to respond. So anyway, I know her best for some of the best Star Trek Next Gen episodes that she wrote. Anyway, Baird Searles worked at BAI. Baird was eventually best known as, besides having this golden voice himself, he was a reviewer at both Galaxy Magazine and later at Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine, or just Asimov's Magazine, I believe, is the proper name. And he was the drama and literature director here in 1967 when I began. It was the radio dramas that he was overseeing and doing, like Delaney's The Star Pit, and programs like Poisoned Arts and The Radio, produced by Charles Potter and David Rapkin, were the things that helped bring me into the station. My uncle being responsible for it all. He did two things. At about age 6 or 7, he got me into science fiction, including having his sister, who I called Mommy, read me early SF while I came home from school for lunch. And she would read me everything, starting with not exactly genre, but it fit. The Wolves of Willoughby Chase by Joan Aiken and any number of things. The other thing he did is he brought me to a Nebula Awards reception in somewhere in the 60s, probably 66 or 67. And in 67, when BAI was holding a fundraising drive, he brought me into the station to answer phones. And I sort of didn't go away. But he told me who these people were. And it was really enlightening. It was really heady for me to meet these people like Joanna Russ. And, well, I've named the names. And, hey, Chris, how are you? And Reggie, so you're there as well. But Chris is, oh, it's early for you, Chris. You're on the West Coast. Anyway, so in the early days at BAI were very, very heady. Actually, I have to say, not just the early days, but the continuing days. And it got to the point where I was so hooked on the station that given a choice between going to school or going to BAI to work, I went to BAI to work. I was cutting school a great deal until I was 16 years old. Then I dropped out. And that was it for school. Haven't graduated yet. So, there were people at BAI who really, really didn't want or need me around because, well, I was 13. And it doesn't matter how well-intentioned at 13 you are, you can get underfoot, what some people say, underfoot overshoe. Don't confuse me with old pitching numbers, Chris. So, those were my beginnings with BAI. As I discussed on Monday's show, 3 to 5, which I'll make sure you all get to see where the archive is for that, I became involved with the music department as well as the drama and literature department. The music department was especially helpful. And also by 1970, Baird Searles left BAI because he thought that the manager of BAI was homophobic. And that's an argument that I will leave to other people. However, I was complaining, nobody's doing science fiction radio anymore. Baird Searles had Of Unicorns and Universes, which he did with Neil Conan, and occasionally Mike Hodel, who is, where was Mike in our news department? Our news director was, of course, Paul Fisher, and our weekend news director was Margot Adler. And having Adler come on, I told the story then. BAI was not a 24-hour-a-day radio station in them days. Bob Fass and Steve Post signed off whenever they bloody well felt like it. And Margot, and then Larry Josephson would come on straight at 7 a.m. sharp. He liked to turn on the transmitter. He liked to begin the day. And nobody was too happy, but Margot made a deal to obtain the time slot during the Hour of the Wolf, the morning twilight, 5 to 7 a.m., because that meant that there was that if Fast wanted to go home, he could go home any time after 3, although he often stayed on the air till 5, sometimes 5:30. Even after Hour of the Wolf began, he sometimes stayed on the air as late as 5:15 or 5:30. But I really didn't mind, because he was the master of freeform radio, and it allowed for a really cool transition kind of thing. If I had a guess, that was another story. But he never really stepped on my toes ever. So Adler turned BAI into a 24-hour-a-day radio station. I believe the correct date would be January 1972, thereby declaring this the 46th year of the 46th year of Hour of the Wolf. In other words, our 45th anniversary would have been in January, mid-January, and then thereby making this year number 46 that we are in the midst of now. Okay. On Mondays, Neil Conan and or Mike Hodel were often her co-hosts, and she generally engineered those on her own. Tuesday through Friday, I was the engineer, and on Thursday and Friday, I was her co-host during what she called the Hour of the Wolf Science Fiction Extravaganza, either the Thursday morning Science Fiction Extravaganza or the Friday morning. And much of this consisted of reading stories on the air. And I was the one who actually started bringing in guests. She didn't know who many of these people were. She had never heard of George Alec Effinger, who I think was the first person who I brought in to read one of his stories on the air. And she was a bit nervous about it. She was also a bit nervous about having me read live on the air. Nowadays, people call such people narrators. But then it was just, we're reading on the radio. And a big difference. It was all live. You know, you blow a line, you either forge ahead or go back a bit. So, Paul followed Fass a bunch too. Paul whom? Fass was on Monday through Friday, and so was Margot, and so was I. So, don't know which Paul, Chris, you are talking about. I'm answering questions being posted on Facebook. If you have questions that you would like to talk on the air about, the telephone number is 347-335-0818. But Adler went away in 1973 to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop. And I was actually accepted that year as well, but it's a 6-week workshop. And I couldn't afford the plane fare, it was on the West Coast, or the rent, or to leave whatever measly little job I had. And besides, if I didn't go with Margot, I could have Margot's radio show for those 6 weeks. And when she came back, she took a different time slot. So I have been on the air, I thought it was 1974. Except that I was doing an interview with Sharon Lee and Steve Miller, who turned out to be in the same class. And they say, no, that was the famous Lost Clarion West, because there wasn't one the next year. And they know that it was 1973, because that's when they started publishing. So I might have been doing this show all the way back since 73, but I don't care. It's the beginning of Hour of the Wolf that I care about. So that is the 46th year of that. Nonetheless, it is 50 years for me at BAI. I've done many things since, including producing free music store concerts. I played some last week, which I then sang along to on the air, and I'm not going to do that again. Because you couldn't hear Schickley and the orchestra of eight and the singers and Linda Hunt and everything. You could hear me better than anybody else. That wasn't what I was thinking of. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning. Do you possess, by any chance, any of the recordings or a recording of Baird Searles?
Did you hear me say that all my recordings were flooded?
No, I just turned you on. I'm sorry.
In March, all my recordings were lost.
I apologize. One of the...
I have ones that I produced, not his.
I loved Of Unicorns and Universes. I
lost.
Rushed home from college just to listen to that. And he read some marvelous things, including material by Alan Garner.
Well, that was only a 15-minute show, though.
It was?
Yes, it was.
Well, I thought it was half hour at least.
Now, sometimes I think he may have done half hour episodes, and of course he did other shows with Neil Conan, but the actual usual commentary was of the show and the reviews and everything, it was primarily listed in the folio as being 15 minutes long.
Do you remember when he read chapter 2, book part 2, book 1?
Well, I produced that.
Yeah,
and that was 1973.
73.
Margot Adler, Dave Marks, and I produced that. That was, and Baird had been out of the station for 4 years at that point. And that I have.
Yes,
but
I know.
I have that.
You
have
played
that
it many times.
That's right. And I'll be playing it again in December. I only have that. Oh, yes, Jonathan's remembering one of my favorite Piglet, I should say Chorchella Keffinger, short stories, really.
Oh, I remember some of the stuff you read by Effinger.
I didn't read it by Effinger. George read it himself.
Oh, yes.
At any rate, yes, of course, I remember the things that I produced.
One of the best things that Baird Searles ever did, bar none, and I have a box with a reel-to-reel tape, is the program he did on the poetry of Lord of the Rings.
Okay, that was produced by Martin Last, Baird's lover, and not Baird.
Oh, I thought it was him.
Baird did some of the voices in it. But Martin, who was technically, got himself the title WBAI's poetry editor, produced that.
Oh, he...
Baird was one of several readers.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. But he did not produce that.
Oh.
And that does exist in the Pacifica archives.
It does.
Ooh, hi, Lisa.
Oh.
And Connie.
Great program. All right. Thank you for the memories.
Okay. Take care. And so that was timely because I was talking about Baird at that point. Now, what I would like to be doing now, let's see if I can give people a sample of Baird's voice. So what I am left with as a result of that flood are whatever had been digitized. And some people, including Bobson out there, have gotten me air checks from years and years ago. And so I'm grateful for having some of that. No, I didn't bring any of Baird's readings with me, alas. But they will be on the air before this year is out. And I have virtually nothing of Margot's because she had brought and compiled whatever things she had of her Hour of the Wolves home to her. I had had a lot of the air checks, but I brought them to her with the intention of having them digitized over at National Public Radio, where she was working. But That did not happen before her very untimely death. Hi, nice to see you, Connie. Well, I'm not seeing you, but I'm virtually seeing you, as it were. So what I do have is I have my Frank Herbert interview, which Margot came in on, so you can hear the two of us together. I have also, now here's the thing. After we did the 50th anniversary celebration on Monday, somebody said, I'd like to hear more about Isaac Asimov getting out of hand. And I pointed out that Isaac was the very first person I interviewed on my own show. I was substituting for Paul Gorman's Lunch Pail. I think it was a weekday afternoon. He was on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays from noon to two, and I think it was a Tuesday. And I subbed for him, and my guests were, I mean, you can't start better than Lester Del Rey, Frederick Pohl, and Isaac Asimov being my guests. But really, Lester and Fred were truly the hosts, were truly the people responsible for making that show listenable, because they were old hands at radio. They had been on Long John Nebel so often. Nebel loved to have science fiction writers, people who could talk about, well, flying saucers. Nebel was very much into the paranormal and stuff like that, sort of the Art Bell of his day. I shouldn't say sort of the Art Bell of his day. Art Bell is attempts to be the Long John Nebel of the modern era. But this is really Long John's turf. And Fred and Lester were old-time radio hands. Isaac was all over the place, as Isaac is. He is an incorrigible and encourageable fellow. As I said, he was my first interview. And I'm not crediting Fred and Lester, because they were really the hosts. They were really the Isaac Wranglers, would be a good way to put them. And I was the last person to interview Isaac, at least, and maybe somebody interviewed him for print after that. But I interviewed him about six weeks before his death. Good night, Connie. I understand it is, after all, moving on to 2 in the morning. Don't forget that this is archived, both the video and the radio program, so you can listen or watch tomorrow. Not that I'm encouraging everybody to tune out and rejoin us. So, so somebody asked me, how was Isaac out of hand? Well, it's who he was. It's who he liked to be. I very often would go over to 8th Avenue, to where Channel 13 had the studios for the Dick Cavett Show, and would watch tapings there, especially if I knew who was going to be on. And I'd always be at the head of the line, so that once, you know, I was like 5 feet from Dick Cavett and Groucho Marx, and noted that all of us were exactly the same height. We're all short people. Also, I may point out, exactly the same height as Harlan Ellison. We're all about 5'4". I don't think that's so short. But there you have it. At any rate, on a live TV show of that style, they do not stop the show. It is expensive and problematic. And Isaac, and this is about the same time that I had had him on the air, Isaac had just published The Sensuous Dirty Old Man by Dr. A. This was, there were all these books, A Sensuous Woman, and they were followed up as blockbusters are by The Sensuous This, The Sensuous Hamster, you know, just went on and on and on. So Ike did The Sensuous Dirty Old Man, and he came out on the Cavett Show wearing a mask, which was a bra. And Cavett stopped the show then and there and said, "Now just stop that. Go back and be a man." And Isaac sort of like whimpered like a whipped dog a little, to use a Harlan Ellison title, went off stage, took off the silliness, and came out again. And he did that show. And this is generally what he was like. I've told many times the story of how I first met him at that Nebula event that I mentioned earlier. And he told me to look him up in the book and phone him. And I did so, and I said, "Is this really you?" I didn't know you would really be listed, as you said. I thought you were putting me off. And he said, "Yes, I know. I tried to get them to list me in the phone book as the Dr. Isaac Asimov, but they won't do it." Shtick. Yeah, Groucho was more than a legend. He was something. I'm so glad to have actually seen him live, even though it was in his... he never had a dotage, Jack, but he was certainly... Quite something. And to have seen him, even just in the interview on the Cavett Show, and to have seen him just, you know, getting out of a cab and walking into the studios, that was a thrill. The other thrill I had was being at a party where I met Myrna Loy. Okay, that's how I've had Jane Fonda on the air. I have pictures of me and Jane posted on, not on Facebook, but on Google Photos. You can look me up on Google Photos and see some of my old... I should make a Facebook album of glory days where I still had red hair and stuff. And and post some of those photos. So I have met many royalty. I'm definitely have always been and continue to be a celebrity hungry kind of person. But the sighting in the field of Groucho Marx, that was a good one. And in the same place. So why am I going on and on about this? Well, because I constantly digress and then have to roll back to find my digressions. So what I have here, I have with me digitized only a couple of months before the flood, thanks to a couple of producers who have taken various interviews and had them digitize old stuff and then animate them. And a project that they do for PBS, very, very cool. And I told them I didn't have that much old stuff. It would have to be recovered and all that. But they wanted to hear the one with Asimov. And I told them it was unlikely how brilliant and scintillating Asimov was. And they said, "Let us worry about that. Send the tapes to such and such an address," which I did. I got it back about, maybe a month later. And I got mailed some WAVE files of that show. So I have it with me. I'm Jules. When did I see him with my own eyeballs? I saw him as he was going into the Dick Cavett Show. I used to go to tapings of the Dick Cavett Show. And he and Cavett got out of a limo and walked into the Channel 13, that's PBS in New York, studios. And I was at the top head of the line, so I got to see Cavett and Groucho step out of the limo and go into the studio. And then I went in and watched the taping of his show. Tom Ward says, "Jennifer Robin is in your world, Jim. Death Confetti is a wonderful work from Feral Press." Well, I don't think she's in my world yet, but on your word, I will look her up. By the way, Tom, meet Jack. Jack, meet Tom. If you don't know each other, you're both really cool radio drama producers. Anyway, audio drama, I guess. To me, radio drama means it's on the radio. And by the way, if you people out there who produce audio drama want to turn it into radio drama, if Hour of the Wolf is here, I invite you to let me broadcast some of your stuff as long as it is commercial free. So, yes, I have that recording. I have the recording of Isaac and Lester Del Rey and Fred Pohl and me. And I will play it if we get a pledge. This is called Ransom. The person from Canada is exempt because that person pledged $100 on Monday. Thank you. And I even have a premium. A premium that we used to have. Oh, yeah. I also met Jack. We should talk sometime. I met other people in vaudeville. I met comedians and magicians, specifically Carl Ballantyne, who some people may remember from McHale's Navy, played Gruber. But he was also the great Ballantyne. He was this wonderful magician who did everything wrong. For example, he would have a top hat sitting on his stool, and he would play to be very drunk, and he would stick his hand all the way down into the top hat before he would pull out the rabbit or whatever. The only thing is that the stool was empty. There were no mirrors. And he stuck his arm all the way down. So the question wasn't, how did he get the rabbit out of the hat? The question is, where did his arm go? Good act. Good act. And he came out of, actually not so much vaudeville, he came out of burlesque. And I used to hang out at Lieutenant's Magic Shop and watch these old-time burlesque, and I guess the older ones, both vaudeville and burlesque, people talk together. And the people at the Magic Shop, which I think still exists as a mail-order house, I'm not sure, they would show tricks to customers who came in, and then sell you the trick. I'd usually get away with buying some flash paper or something like that. Okay, so premium. I said I have a premium. Indeed, I do. It is right here. The premium, in other words, if you pledge $50 to WBAI, you will then own your very own certified wormhole. Or at least a certificate for one. You can redeem it if you can get to that wormhole and show us that you did. So that's the deal. You want a wormhole? Here, if you're watching on Facebook, there it is, backwards. It says backwards. It's mirror image because I'm basically this video is a selfie, 1 2-hour selfie. Is the WBAI Wormhole Certificate. And it saith, this is the special Apollo edition, be it known and proclaim to all that blank, and David Dozer will fill in your name, and he will certify this and give it a number, is recorded as the true and legal owner of the next wormhole designated as a WBAI wormhole located within the nearest galaxy. I suppose we should say this or the nearest galaxy, so it doesn't have to be Andromeda. This ownership will last in perpetuity so long as the wormhole remains stable and a proper singularity. Said wormhole may be sublet as vacation property or will to heirs or leased to motion picture producers or issued for product endorsements. This certificate is duly recorded by the WBAI Wormhole Authority on Earth, New York City. Now, what makes this really cool? And I mean, it is really cool. This thing has an actual value. And what is it? Again, I'm holding it up so that those on Facebook can see. Each and every one is signed by Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist of the City University of New York, author of the latest book of his at that time, Physics of the Impossible, host of Explorations here on WBAI in New York, at 99.5 FM. Ooh, I worked in a station break the same way. No, I don't remember Gordon's Magic Shop on Lower Broadway. I remember Lou Tannen's, and I remember another shop also in the Times Square district. And also, finishing the thing on Michio, it's at mkaku.org. And I designed these certificates and public domain images that I got off the very first versions of Google Images. Yes, these are that old. And this vector line drawing that I got off the NASA website of an Apollo lander. I think it was for the 25th anniversary of the Apollo missions. Probably the moon landing. That's a $50 pledge to WBAI. The telephone number is 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602. Or you can go to WBAI.org and follow the prompts to donate to your favorite program, which, as we all know, of course, Hour of the Wolf. Or you can even text. Oh, yeah, Gordon's Novelty Shop, just south of 23rd Street. Closed to the general public except at Halloween. Yes, yes, I do remember that place, as a matter of fact. And I was not necessarily, I guess, the general public, because I got in there probably thanks to Carl Ballantyne. Ballantyne ran a little thing down at near the South Street Seaport in the Fulton Fish Market when it was still just a stinky fish market, called the IMPS, the Independent Magical Performer Society. It was all kids like myself. And it was so much fun learning sleight of hand and stuff like that. I have very small hands, so I was never very good at it, but I just loved the company and the whole premise. So the telephone number again to pledge, 516-620-3602, or go to WBAI.org, or, Facebook people are talking amongst themselves, or you can even text the pledge. And you do that by sending the letters WBAI, which used to stand for We Beg at Intervals, but the I has to be incessant nowadays. We beg arbitrarily, incessantly? Maybe. At any rate, you text WBAI to the number 41444. And let me know that you've done it. Send me an email to jim@ourwolf.com, or if you make the phone call, I think there's a way of my finding out by using this computer here. And this computer, I've never fully understood how one reads pledges here. Da-da-dum, dum-dum-dum. Somebody signed in on Facebook here and didn't sign. Max! Max, sign out. Oh, boy, oh, boy. I can post as Max Schmid, everybody. I will do him the favor of signing out if I can figure out how. Da-da-da. There. I have to sign up myself when it's done. Okay, he's got two tabs open, yep, with exactly the same material. But somewhere on here, there should be a thing. Ah, yes, with order numbers. This is it. I think, if I take a look. Yes, I can find out if you call and pledge, I think. So, again, the telephone number is area code 516-620-3602. And pledge $50. That's $1 for every year that I have worked at WBAI. Yes, I will use this power wisely. I have to figure out what I will put on Facebook as Max Schmid. Actually, I think if I just close all the tabs, he'll be logged out from here. Because to go back in, somebody's going to need his password. And if he does what I do, which is, you know, using the dual authentication system, which is very useful, even if somebody knows the password, they won't be able to get back in. So please, a $50 pledge to WBAI, to Jim at OurWolf.com, HOURWOLF, and I will play the show, which is in fact incredibly embarrassing. Incredibly embarrassing, because the show sucks that much. But you will get to hear Isaac Asimov and Fred Pohl and Lester Del Rey. And if somebody asks, or you can also tell me on Facebook that you've pledged, I will take your word for it. Or you can call me on the air and tell me that you have pledged. That number is 516-620-3602. But the important number for the moment, 347-335-0818. So let's see, what tales should I tell? You can also call me on the air and ask me questions about my 50 years or observations or whatever about Hour of the Wolf and WBAI. And again, I'm really grateful to the show that was on 3 to 5 p.m. this past Monday, and I will post links to that. However, we didn't have time to take phone calls or for me to just blather on, because we were honoring not just myself, but Jim Irsay and Max Schmid and Janet Coleman and David Dozer, and which, as I said, if we add them together, I think it represents about 220 or 230 years of WBAI posted all together. I figured out that I am what they call a six-decader. Let's see. So I started in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, aughts, and the teens. Yes. So this is my sixth decade. Thank you, Adina, who just closed, no, opened her map. Anybody out there know what kind of map we're talking about? It involves a pledge, or I think it's actually an oath, isn't it? I swear that I'm up to no good, something like that. Joe Rowling probably didn't care for swearing that much. So pledge is good. I pledge that I am up to no good. Oh, these people used to work for Marvel. Sigh. Okay. So insular, this community. So, let's see. I have a very brief interview with Matty Pryor from, but a mere 2 years ago. I've played the Ken Liu recently. As I said, I have the Frank Herbert. I'm not going to play the Michael Swanwick this morning. I'm going to use that soon. And Stan Robinson I played only about 4 months ago. So I'm not going to replay that now. So, yeah, I brought with me the Asimov because people brought it up. And if people want, I'll play that. Otherwise, you can just call and ask me questions and talk about the years. But you, too, can get a WBAI wormhole certificate for a mere pledge of $50, and which is but a drop in the bucket to help us out of our current financial and legal woes. But every drop in the bucket helps, especially at this hour. And you do that by phoning 516-620-3602 or pledging at give2wbai.org. Let me make sure that that actually works. Let me just type in, because I have, for everybody says you have to use the number 2. But I'm just using the letters. And I believe that should take you to the correct place. It does. It does. Okay, everybody. Why is everybody on the air always saying the number 2? Use the number 2. You don't have to. givetowbai.org. It simply redirects you to the numeral to give2wbai.org, but you don't have to say it. And that was the problem with that URL, with that web address, is how you say all the time, give numeral to wbai.org, and it's just give to wbai.org. You want to use a number and save one keystroke, that's up to you. But I suggest just type in give to wpai.org and pledge $50. And for your premium, choose the WBAI wormhole certificate or just donate it straight out. Let me mention, by the way, for no particular reason other than I have the information right here, about the next, I mentioned the NYRSF readings, New York Review of Science Fiction readings. The next one will be, as is typical for us, the first Tuesday of the month. That will be Tuesday, November 7th. And our readers will be Chris Dykman and Shannon S.A. Chakraborty. Chris Dykman lives in New York City. She is a founding member of the Altered Fluid Writers Group. Her work has appeared in Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, Year's Best Fantasy 9, Strange Horizons, Sybil's Garage, The Best of All Flesh, and Sympathy for the Devil. She has stories upcoming in Ellen Datlow's Alice in Wonderland anthology, Mad Hatters and March Hares, and coming in January in Analog. Read more of her work at What's Wrong with Muriel Puce? That's PUCE.com. What's Wrong with Muriel Puce? Our other reader will be Shannon Chakraborty, who is a fantasy writer from New York City. Her debut novel, The City of Brass, is the first book in the, Davabad? D-A-E-V-A-B-A-D. Davabad? I know it will be of subcontinental origin, because that is what interests her the most. You may note the last name, Chakraborty, but Shannon is of Irish descent. Nonetheless, her husband, not so much. So she's fascinated, of course, by the part of the world that he originally hailed from. So, the Davabad, I'm going to have to call her and ask. We talk through email, and that doesn't, you know. She's read for us once before when Cam Roberson or Rob Cameron or both of them produced a reading for us. January of last year. It was really great. This is an epic fantasy set in the 18th century Middle East that will be published November 17 by Harper Voyager. When not buried in books about Mughal portraiture and Omani history, S.A. enjoys hiking, knitting, and cooking unnecessarily complicated meals for her family. I cook simpler meals for mine. You can find her online at S.A. Chakraborty. That's S-A-C-H-A-K-R-A-B-O-R-T-Y.com or on Twitter at, you know, it's an at sign, S-C-H-A-K-R-A-B-S, where she likes to ramble about history, politics, and Islamic art. She is a proud member of the Brooklyn Speculative Fiction Writers Group. Okay, so that's at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Tuesday, November 7th. Admission is free, but please donate at the door. That's not to donate to WBAI. That's to donate to the NYRSF Reading Series. Ha-ha! Because we're not even a non-profit. We just need money, and I have to rent out the space that I owe money for and stuff like that. So, yeah, your donations are gratefully accepted by our House Manager Nebula Award finalist, Barbara Krasnoff. So, and I've little doubt that our two readers will be Nebula Award finalists, and In December, our singers were doing a music show. We'll have been Nebula Award, if not finalists, winners in the case of Catherine M. Valenti and Sarah Pinsker. I bet that Jack Kincaid, who is watching this on Facebook, knows the name Sarah Pinsker, since she's had a couple of pieces, podcast Nightmare Magazine, which Jack hosts at nightmare-magazine.com is where you go to read those stories, and you can look at the archives. But better, even better than reading, is to listen to them on the podcast, and you can do that there. Okay, so that's the Nearsif stuff. So, nobody wants to hear the Asimov. That's fine by me. You can also just post on Facebook that you've pledged. If you do that, magicians and theater people, we're welcome. Yes, exactly. Well, I was like, okay, somebody asks, have you ever seen somebody was asking somebody else, have you ever seen Edison's first films of vaudeville acts? Yes, but I really liked The Cat. Edison made a movie of a cat, you see. Okay, so I think it's time to play something. If it's not, the Asimov, maybe it's a piece of music. And if it is a piece of music, I will lower the tune. It's October. It's October. That means, and I haven't played Tamlin once yet this month. And I don't know how many more times I will be able to be on during October, since it's the duration of the fun drive. You're playing on a screen in an editing suite on campus, Jim. Oh, yeah, more or less. Wait, oh, no, this is a conversation. I was finally rejected, not naming names, by Marvel in the late 70s when I failed to ink Gene Colan's Dracula as a test on Xerox paper. Curious. Frank Heller, who's formerly of BAI and occasionally a listener and stuff like that, was one of the crusty bunkers working with Neil Adams. So Neil Adams donated some original artwork to BAI along with his giant subway posters for his Broadway show, Warp. And, of course, Chris Claremont of Marvel has been on this show several times. And going to the other side, to the more evil side, in March at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, Alisa Quitney, who is the editor of Liminal Comics and was an editor for National, that is to say DC Comics, and was the editor and actually author of several of the Sandman comics with Neil Gaiman, for whom she is an editor and provocateur. She helped get the Norse mythology book that Neil wrote. Wonderful book. She helped to bring that to life. So, let's hear Bill Jones' version of Tamlin, and I'm going to turn down the speakers here in the studio so it won't warp. That was the play. Warp and Warp 2 and Warp 3, but Warp 2 and Warp 3 never made it to Broadway. I saw Warp twice, and I really loved it. The stagecraft was absolutely fabulous, but the best thing absolutely was the poster, and Neil Adams signed and donated a whole bunch of posters that we gave away as premiums. We give them away. These premiums, like the WBAI wormhole certificate, are gifts to you in exchange for your pledges. We're not selling anything. It's not legal for us to do that. We can, however, out of the goodness of our heart, give you a gift to say thanks for the donations that you make to the radio station. So here, then, is one of my favorite versions of the classic child's ballad, Tamlin. This one performed by Bill Jones. The voice may not sound like a Bill, but it is.
Bridal ring.
Bill Jones with The Tale of Tamlin. Here, over listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. Again, the program Hour of the Wolf. And about Bill Jones. She seems to have put out three albums between 2001 and 2003. And I suspect you can buy them online through your preferred streaming service is probably the way to do it. I don't know if the albums, physical albums themselves, are in print, but you can stream her stuff legally. And so you can buy the digital versions of them, or if you subscribe to a streaming service, Bill Jones. And the album again, Panchpuran, Panchpuran. There are, I have like over 25 or 30 versions of Tamlin, and that and Thomas the Rhymer are my favorite songs that refer directly to Samhain or Halloween or what have you. And, I mean, there's, of course, Oingo Boingo, besides Danny Elfman's score for The Nightmare Before Christmas, which they always play before Christmas. I don't get why. It's a Halloween movie, period. Where was I going? I've driven my own thoughts out of my head, which is really bizarre because the head is empty enough as it is. Oh, yes, Danny Elfman. And, oh, yes, as Oingo Boingo, let's have a party. There's a full moon in the sky. It's the hour of the wolf and I don't want to die. I have to play that every year, whether or not I will get to. I'm not sure. Ooh, all these radio people talking about Marvel people. Wow, that's marvelous. Nah. Anyway, if you'd like to speak on the air, ask me questions about the years of WBAI or Hour of the Wolf, the telephone number again is 347-335-0818. People watching this on Facebook Live, and by the way, you too can go to Facebook Live and actually watch this show in progress. Just go to Facebook and look me up, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you'll see that there's a Facebook Live event. And you click on that, and you can see it about, 30 or 40 seconds late after the broadcast itself. If you want to get really weirded out, you can listen to the broadcast over WBAI.org or over 99.5 FM in New York City and watch it, and everything will be in a different time zone. It can really drive you bonkers if you're not already there with me. The number to call and pledge to WBAI again, 516-620-3602, or go to givetowbai.org and get yourself a wormhole certificate signed by Dr. Michio Kaku. Now, you can't get more authoritative than that, can you? Einstein never put out wormhole certificates. He didn't know as much about wormholes as did Michio Kaku. I'm not sure if he theorized them or not. I think he thought it was possible. Hey, Bill. Saying hi to people joining us on Facebook. So, get yourself your wormhole certificate right here. $50 pledge to BAI. You can also text it. 41444 is the number to text to, and the message you want to send is WBAI, and I believe that what happens when you do that is that they then send you over your SMS message a link which will then take your mobile phone to a page where you can give money. Isn't that wonderful? But if you'd like to call and chat, 347. I have to actually look at these numbers because they are so unrhythmic. 347-335-0818. And to pledge, 516-620-3602. But we have a little less than half an hour left, so let us chat for a bit about the history of Hour of the Wolf, Margot Adler, people who've appeared on the program, the history of WBAI. I have seen it all. Not all, but I started when BAI was part of the Pacifica collection of stations. I try to avoid the word network. We network with each other, but we are not a radio network because we don't all simulcast, if you see. Again, the Facebook transmission is several seconds ahead of... No, it can't be ahead of BAI's FM signal, Bill. Are you saying the online signal? Did Vonnegut ever appear on Hour of the Wolf? No, not directly. I did interview him for about 5 minutes after Larry Josephson did an exhaustive, brilliant interview with Vonnegut, which is available in the Pacifica Archives under the name, I think it's Trout Fishing in America. Trout referring to Kilgore trout. So, and I've played that on the air. And I did my 5-minute interview with Vonnegut. I should have done more. I was always shy. I didn't exactly stalk him, but I was working for a time when I was working for Ziff Davis at 1 Park Avenue. They're not there anymore, so I can say the address. He lived not far away, and there was a pizza joint on 2nd Avenue that I liked to go to. And Vonnegut was there almost every single day reading the newspaper, not looking at anybody, not conferring with anybody, and I never interrupted him except once. The one time was I simply waited until he was turning a page and I handed him a pen and I handed him a copy of Cat's Cradle, paperback copy, and asked him to autograph it, and he did. It's ahead? How can it be ahead? Oh, I know how it can be ahead of our broadcast signal, because our so-called broadcast signal is not going to Empire State Building, cursed be thy name, over phone lines. It's going over an internet signal, as is, of course, the Facebook feed. So it's very bizarre that according to... Bill, are you on the air tomorrow morning? Or were you preempted for the fun drive? Bill Propp appears on the air during Radio Unnameable frequently. And I'm not sure if Radio Unnameable is on the air this week during the fun drive. But at any rate, yeah, it's really weird, the idea that the Facebook signal comes earlier. Than the broadcast signal. Well, the signal is broadcast, but the getting from here to the place, to the transmitter where it is broadcast from, that is really, where is the list? Number 3'd up. Okay? There's 7 words that they say we must not use, although that's incorrect. I won't go into the whole history unless somebody calls up to ask about it. But, they are and tits. Those are the 7 words that Carlin says. And as he points out, the last one, and actually the 2nd one, aren't prescribed by anybody. These were Carlin's choice, not the choice of the FCC. I don't know how to read the tea leaves. Neither do I. I'll stick to coffee grinds anyway, for the most part. Although I have to cut down on that as well. If you'd like to call up and chat, 347-335-0818. If you'd like to request a tune, a part of an interview. Oh, I imagine I should just, like, you know, suck it up and play part of the Asimov interview, right? Yeah. I suppose so. It makes me cringe because I don't like to listen to myself. It's really difficult. And there is nothing worse than listening to my very, very young, less professional self. So this recording goes back to about, late 1971 to mid-1972, somewhere in there, with the radio program Lunch Pail, which was Paul Gorman's show, and I was filling in. Facebook is about 2 seconds ahead of the TuneIn feed. Yes, but TuneIn is also an internet signal. So it seems like our direct internet signal, or the direct from my phone, is what it is. This Facebook Live is not coming through WBAI's equipment. It's coming through my cell phone. And I guess it's got a faster feed than the WBAI signal. This is something that ought to be pointed out to the WBAI management or ops department or somebody. Okay, so a piece. I'm going to drop the needle anywhere. Now we'll start at the beginning, which doesn't have the very beginning of the show anyway. And we'll hear a little of my very first live radio show. We played a lot of recorded radio drama with Poison Darts that I was on Monday. Again, I'll post the link for that. But here was my very first hosting gig on these same airwaves over 40 years ago.
Tell me, how is the Century Sturdy Old Man doing?
Me or the book?
Both.
Oh, well, the book is now in paperback and apparently doing pretty well. At least the paperback people are unexpectedly putting out a second printing, last I heard of it.
Is it printed on nice, soft paper?
Whatever do you mean by that, Lester?
I thought that might account for us doing well.
And I don't follow you, Lester.
You never could, though. You tried hard enough.
Only girl.
That's true. One thing you got to say about Lester, he's not a girl.
That's true.
And that's about all you can say about Lester, too. And as for myself,
that's a good
I'm
example of
health,
Ike's humor.
Let's see. I don't think that too many people listening, other than science fiction fans who possibly already know about the show, know exactly
how
much
enunciate,
fandom
perhaps?
Really is a part of science fiction,
Are
what
you
it
a fan,
does.
Jim? Active in fandom?
I'm active in fandom in as much as I go to conventions, attend Lunarians meetings occasionally, belong to FISFSQ.
So your brain has already begun to rot. I mean, that's what started us all on this.
That's right. You show me a science fiction writer who's been writing ever since he was in his late teens or early 20s, and I'll show you a science fiction writer who was once a science fiction fan and has never recovered.
Has there been any... has fandom had any influence on anybody's work here?
Created it. If it hadn't been for fandom, Isaac and I wouldn't have been in it. I'm pretty sure of that.
And as for Lester, he still isn't in it, so that's all.
Well, Lester was a remote fan. He wrote letters. He was off in the boondocks most of the
Technically,
time.
Technically, I was still what was known as an active fan. That's an inside word that means simply what it sounds like, active fan.
He just says that because he wants to be a member of First Fandom. He really just sat out there and wrote letters once
I don't want to be a member of First Fandom. I am a member of First Fandom.
Let's face it, he is First Fandom.
That's when they had the letterheads that said science fiction.
Not quite.
That was a science fiction lead.
Okay, okay. This is bizarre and some of it inaudible. Let us skip ahead to about, 20 minutes in.
Because you didn't, you had an idea that what you sold the story to the magazine came out in the magazine, that's the end of it.
Way back in about somewhere in the 50s, early 50s, I think, maybe even the late 40s, Street and Smith, which then ran Astounding, voluntarily in their own court, sent me a whole mess of papers which I signed, which made each individual story belong to me, except for the first serial rights, which they already own, which they already used, so that after that I didn't even have to go to them. And again, they did this of their own accord. I never asked them. I presume they did it for the other writers too, not just for me.
It was ethical publishing for the day. For instance, they used one of my stories again in a magazine of their own where they had some reprints. It's called, what was it? It was Out of Unknown Worlds or something like that. I'd sold the original story to Unknown Worlds, and they were doing this reprint. And I assumed, well, they have all rights. They're using it themselves. I'll never get anything. But they sent me a penny a word again.
Well, it's my experience with the publishers, both of the magazines and the books. And at least in the magazines, of course, we have to remember the publishers never get rich anyway, you know. But you start banging away the publishers, it's one poor man hitting at another. But it's my experience that although they might sometimes have been rather ungenerous at times, they were never malicious or vicious. At least I never found them so. They always treated me fair.
There are people who would disagree with you. There are some publishers who were far less than... I guess ethical is the word I'm looking for. Most of them, however, were not. They, as you say, they were just up against... They were caught between the upper and nether millstone. You know, they had people wanting money from them, but they didn't have it to give, really, because there wasn't that much money in it. There was a time early in science fiction when science fiction magazines did make money. The first couple years of Gernsback's magazines, Amazing Stories, and then he lost it, not because the magazine wasn't making money, but because something happened called 1929, and he lost everything and started up again. But for those first few issues, they were big business. They were really showing quite a profit.
It's strange, though, when you stop and think of it. Science fiction really began in the Great Depression, the early years of the Great Depression. It started before then, but it was going pretty strongly then. Nobody had any money. But those magazines at the time were selling for 25 cents. They brought out quarterlies and annuals that sold for 50 cents, and I think one that sold for $1 a copy.
I think they were only 50.
Well, maybe 50.
The annual, I think, was 50.
Yeah, 50 cents. those darn magazines sold better than most of the magazines are selling today.
They sold beautifully. I in my looking through old magazines, which for some reason I was doing a while ago, I've forgotten the reason. I read an article, an editorial by Hugo Gernsback. His editorials were called things like The Wonders of Space, The Wonders of Color, The Wonders of Light, The Wonders of... This was called The Wonders of Distribution.
Yeah.
And he was complaining bitterly because out of every 100 copies he printed, only 90 got sold.
Oh, that should happen.
The good old days.
There was a 10% loss, and he was urging all of his readers to order their copies ahead to cut down this intolerable 10% loss. Of every paper-bound book and magazine that's published in the field, every time you buy one, you're paying for two, because half the copies do not get sold.
Actually, you're paying for two and a half, because about 60% don't get sold.
Well, it depends on whether you're in the books or the magazines. But
the
paper-bound, you know, that's where the big action is, and the paper-bound book industry average, I think, is 50%. They're very close to 50%.
Of course, in a sense, the paperback books today are the magazines of yesterday, because the magazines are under so much trouble that it's practically impossible to make money on them.
There are a series of, at least more than one, history of science fiction being written now. I know that James Gunn, for instance, is doing a history of science fiction for Prentice Hall, and I think there are others in the works, too.
I know there are others in the works.
As a matter of fact,
sitting at this table is
right,
probably writing
Lester
one.
Del Rey is probably writing one.
Yes, I am.
Okay, good. Anyway, I wrote an introduction to Jim Gunn's, and since there's no point in writing one on the importance of science fiction or on the history of science fiction. He did that in a book. I wrote a nostalgia piece.
And you're just the man to do that, Isaac.
Yeah, you've got a lot to be nostalgic about, Isaac.
Ah, well, both you guys are older than I am, so... All right, only 2 weeks. Only 2 weeks. He always objects when I say he's older than I am. That's Fred.
What's your IQ, Ian?
It's a 1 point higher than yours.
1 point lower, dummy.
Oh, 1 point lower, higher. What's the difference?
Are you a member of Mensa?
Yes, I am, as a matter of
you
fact.
You are.
But they insisted. So anyway.
I resisted, too.
I wouldn't take their dumb test.
My feeling is if you've got to be exclusive, you don't want to be exclusive by joining 2%. When they make it 0.002%, then it's worth trying to join.
But in any case, as I was saying, I wrote this introduction, and I wrote a nostalgia piece about my feelings when I was a young fan, before I started being a writer. And for goodness sakes, I nearly reduced myself to tears. The thought of those old magazines, those covers, the feeling I had when I saw them on the stands when I read them first time, there's nothing that's happened to me ever since in life that was that pure a joy. Yeah. And this is true of a great many people. Science fiction for the young, anyway, of certain kinds of young, is the acme of life, the acme and peak of life.
I don't know if it is exactly what it was 35 or 40 years ago.
Once in a while it is now.
No, there's a different thing that happened. For one thing, in the 30s, if you were a kid who was interested in science or technology, where would you find it? You know, you could read the professional journals if you knew how, but they're not a lot of sexy interest. You know, they're rather dull. There was not very good science reporting anywhere.
Mm-hmm. No.
There are a few books by people like Jeans and Eddington and like that, but there was not the volume of things like the Scientific American or the Reportage in the New York Times.
Nothing for younger readers.
And nothing for kids. It was much good.
And once you found science fiction, it was completely different from the real world. There was nothing in the newspapers, nothing around you that was like it
at
all.
That's right. There was nothing about space travel in any newspaper in the world.
Science has to be cautious.
The whole advance guard of science was represented only in the science fiction magazine. Yeah, things like the Home and Orbits were first published in this country in Wonder Stories.
Well, I guess we're lucky we were young when we were Fred and Lester.
There's still plenty to write about. One of the things people keep asking me is, how can you find anything to write about now that science has caught up with science fiction? Well, that's a bunch of nonsense, because science has always caught up with science fiction. Science fiction uses the speculations that's done by that are being done by honest scientists. When I came across the first magazine I ever bought, it was an issue of Wonder Stories I've forgotten the title of it. Otto Willy Geil had written it, and I think it was Flight into Eternity or something like that. I can't remember what the title was. That gave me the first glimpse I had of the honest principles of spaceships. I hadn't come across Obert's little book on it or anything like that.
The only way you would within a science fiction
That's magazine. Right. But that didn't mean that science wasn't up with the story, because all Otto Willy Geil was doing was taking the honest mathematical speculation of Obert and a few others and putting it into a story.
Besides, science fiction advances too. People who think that because we reached the moon by chemical rockets, we have caught up with science fiction. In science, the Skylark of Space, which appeared in 1928, forever outmoded stories about trips to the moon by chemical rockets, as though that fact alone were worth a science fiction story. So that what we've accomplished in 1969 in science fiction was passé 50 years ago.
Oh, you can still.
There's a great example of the rate at which science gets outmoded in science fiction in a story John Campbell wrote in 1931, I think. You know, there was no such thing as atomic energy at that time, but it was already outmoded in science fiction because John's story was called When the Atoms Failed. It was about what replaced atomic energy.
Mm-hmm. Gary Fried, who's engineering the show, would like to ask a question.
Yes, I'd like
Do we have to put these on to hear him?
Yeah.
You'll notice that I put mine on already, being smarter than you two.
Also intuitive, because the question is to you, Mr. Asimov.
Uh-huh.
It was about the Foundation series, which I consider one of the best trilogy. Well, the best trilogy, that's limiting it.
You're very
the best.
One well, of the let's best see if Lester jumps best, in with his thing about how it was.
Books of any
books
kind
of
ever
any,
written.
Well, books of science fiction, books on...
Don't encourage him, Gary.
But your question,
My
Gary.
Question is, the series was... the psychohistory was supposed to take place over a 1,000-year interim, and you only covered about a 400-year interim in the books. I was wondering if you had intended to go on, if you left it there on purpose because of the fact that you sort of left it settled at that
halfway
point.
Halfway legitimate question from to, the novice interviewer.
Well, I tell you, when I first started writing it, I intended to go through the entire 1,000-year period and to take my time doing it and write it for the rest of my life because I knew and I had a good thing going. However, the Foundation Trilogy, as it now appears, took me 8 years to write on and off, and it got more and more complicated all the time, and I kept getting older. And by the time the last story was written, I was 30 years old, no longer 22 as I was when I first started, and I wanted to do other things. I no longer wanted to be tied down to the Foundation, and it had gotten too complicated anyway.
There was one other factor. He lost his copy of the Decline of the Roman Empire.
There was another factor, too, because the truth of the matter is he sat down with all his ingenuity and tried to find out where a second Foundation that was supposed to supersede the first one was. And he located it in about four different places, and it turned out he was wrong each time. And after that, he didn't want to show people that he didn't know where he was going with the story anymore. Recently, I told him that he had already found out where the second Foundation was and hadn't recognized it when he found it, but he doesn't want to admit that either.
Lester has decided many years ago that there was no hope in trying to write his own story, so he's desperately trying to write mine.
No, I'm only desperately trying to write it because I want to save a good idea from your hands, Isaac.
How come you never told me it was a good idea when I was writing it? Only now.
No, I kept telling you. I remember in 1950 coming up to you and telling you hadn't figured out where the second Foundation was yet, and why didn't you do it right?
Well, actually, the foundation stories were written when I was in my 20s. They're the kind of stories that you do best when you're young. Now I'm sort of old and curling around the edges, and I've got to do other things.
Actually, you still can, if you're reasonably careful about it, find where Isaac buried his second Foundation. It's in one of his other books. It's a pretty good book, although he didn't recognize what he was doing when he wrote it. You'll find it in Pebble in the Sky. That's where the obvious second Foundation has to be, because of all the accoutrements of a second Foundation are there.
Pebble in the Sky, Doubleday, 1950.
No, it doesn't cost $19.
No, it appeared in 1950 first, and it has a picture of me on the back of the book jacket, which was taken when I was 25 years old. I should look like that now.
You do.
That's only
unfortunately.
That's only because you love me, Lester.
Okay, and on that, now it seems like a perfectly good note to down that with. So that was my very, very first gig as a live radio talk show host. And the only reason it came off at all, was because Lester Del Rey and Frederick Pohl were long-time radio professionals. That's it. They really saved my rear, and they really did a wonderful thing for me. So, and they got Isaac to talk like Isaac. Now, every time I took a break, right, there's a point about, 10 minutes from where we were listening there, that I played Leon Russell's song, Stranger in a Strange Land, which has virtually nothing to do with the book, right? But I play that, I'm outroing the song, and I'm saying, so that was Leon Russell performing Stranger in a Strange Land. And before I can even say the album or anything like that, Isaac comes up with, you know, that's a funny thing, not everybody would know it, but a fellow by the name of Robert A. Heinlein, we're all rolling our eyes, wrote a novel called Stranger in a Strange, and God bless him, Fred Pohl and Lester, like, took the ball away from him in the schoolyard, as it were. But this schoolyard is still here for the moment over WBAI New York. It is time for me to sign off. I have about 30 seconds left. So thank you all for listening. Thank you on Facebook for watching. And this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. You can find me on Facebook, or you can write me at jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Ross Chamberlain has a news flash. Oh, thank you. Okay, very good. So, nighty-night all. I will stay on Facebook for about 3 minutes after, but it is time to go out with one of my favorite all-time songs for October and Steel I Span, of course, Thomas the Rhymer. Everybody, have a good morning, and if I don't talk to you until November, happy Samhain. Take care, and be good to each other. WBAI, New York.
Motherland!
Natagan.
Nuavit.
Natagan.
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 Natagan!
Amaya Gumba.
Assalamu alaikum. Hi, baby.
Start being African because we got to America, and we can't stop because we're here. We're African forever. African, we said in the 60s, and that's our organization. It's not just an identity, it's also a destiny, and therefore a duty. We will be African forever. Therefore, we have a moral obligation to make this the best life possible. and to give our lives to making sure we leave a legacy worthy of the name in history, African.
Number one, first you have to realize that up until 1959, Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized. And well, and naturally, it was so negative until it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African. And in hating Africa and hating the African, we ended up even hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree.
No matter your nationality, you have the identity of an African. I'm only mimicking poorly Peter Tosh. Basically, there's a long ancestry. There's a long history. You see, think of the fact that if you have African blood in you and you're in the West, for example, you somehow inevitably always get discriminated against, one way or the other. So you might think you're not African, etc. You were born in the, you know, Caribbean, West Indies, in England, in Europe, America, etc. But you still have that sense of connection.
Africans are people of African descent, historically, and who have ultimately African cultural roots.
What really made me start this mission was I did a speaking engagement in the United States during Black History Month. And there was a little boy there. I was dressed like this. His name was Jonathan. And I said, he said, "Oh, you look pretty." I said, "Oh, thank you very much." And I said, "Well, you know, I live in Africa. I live in Ghana." I said, "And you're an African." He said, "Oh, no, I'm not African." You see, in Africa, you have wars, you have famines, they don't take care of their people. So I am definitely not an African. That in itself really showed me the importance of exposing our young people to their roots.
They say literally, I'm not an African. Come on, look at your color. You are an African whether you like it or not. And that's, from Malcolm X, that's the phrase I like for those who don't think they're an African. You just happen to be.
And I think it is only when Africans everywhere think of themselves first and foremost as Africans, not as British citizens, not as American citizens. It is only when we see ourselves as Africans that the continent of Africa will be able to progress.
It isn't simply just to do with skin color.
Africans are very diverse, and we come in all, you know, shapes, color, sizes, and I really reject Europeans coming up with a definition of what an African should look like.
So, you see, there is a dilemma even there. They used to call the Roman Empire, they used to call Hic Sunt Leones, here you find lions, or Abyssinia, the whole continent of Africa, the land of the black man. And then Africa came into place by, but it was always others who defined them, and we used that terms, but it's something that has to be revised.
We have to wash our brains of this image of Africa that has been fashioned, created, and even patented by Europeans.
Africa was not a continent that was based upon color or any set features. It was a blending of people of different colors and different features. It wasn't like Europe.
It has to do also with socialization and a certain way of living. But the reason why that gap exists is that people who haven't been to Africa don't feel connected, haven't had that socialization. So basically, they have to undergo it somehow.
There are basically three groups of people living in Africa. They're Africans, they're Europeans, and they're Arabs. And both the Europeans and Arabs have been saying that they're African when it suits their purpose. We must be careful that we distinguish nationality and citizenship from identity. in this question.
If I go to India tomorrow and I live in India, do I then become an Indian? You've got to be a bit careful about that.
Now, your identity is your history, your geography, and the values that grow out of that, a whole range of issues that go to make up a distinctive identity. It is the thing that holds a group of people together. It's that invisible thing that tells people how to behave in specific circumstances. It's that specific thing that enables a people to identify, defend, or promote their interests in a flash.
So you get your identity from two sources: historical origin and social location. Where'd you originally come from? We didn't come from Paris. We didn't come from the moon. You see, we came from Africa. So we're African. Where are we now? We're in America. So we're African-American. That seems simple to me. If I was in Brazil, we're African-Brazilians or Afro-Brazilians. It's the same thing with other places when you were outside of Africa, i.e. in the diaspora. We say we're African first, and then we locate the place we are.
Today, African people have to have a debate that will fix, as much as one could fix these things, African identity, which is different from the identity of the Afrikaners in South Africa, or of the English and the other Europeans in Kenya. Various peoples may have an African passport that says, I belong to this state or this super state called Africa. But it doesn't mean that all of them are identifiable culturally in the same group. And very often we make this mistake of mixing up identity with nationality.
If we're honest, we have to recognize that being African today is actually quite futuristic. We're not saying that we're going back to how we used to live 500 years ago, because 500 years ago we didn't necessarily have a common African identity. But part of repairing ourselves would be to repair some of the weaknesses that we had in some of our ancient systems, some of the quirks even in our identities. And we have to reformulate that. And we have to look at what is required today. You know, what is it we have to do? What is the legacy we're going to leave?
We need to revert back to what our forefathers used to say, that we need to be proud to be African. So all these values are human values in my understanding. So we therefore need to ensure that we preserve that African heritage. And the only way to preserve that African heritage, we need to transmit from generation to the next so that these things are not forgotten.
Good afternoon and welcome to WBAI 99.5 FM on the web at WBAI.org, broadcasting across New York, Metro, and the Tri-State. You're listening to an extended version of Afrobeat Radio, a public affairs program presenting African perspectives on global issues. I am Wuyi Jacobs. Good afternoon and welcome to our special fund drive day. In the studio with me is Catherine Davis.
Hello.
Welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be here with you again.
Thank you.
To be able to share this with our listeners, because we just heard something that was pretty amazing, and that's just a piece of what you're offering today. So I think people are in for a real treat, those of you who are tuned in live to this program, Afrobeat Radio, with Uwe Jacobs. And I am joining him in studio. I'm Catherine Davis.
Thank you for joining me in the studio. And thanks to Reggie Johnson, for engineering the show. So it's a fun drive Fundrive Week, Fall Fundrive, which takes a pretty much a good part of the month. But as you know, we have to do this. We have to come and interact with you, the listeners, because it's the interaction between the radio station, the producers, the managers, and so on and so forth, and you that makes this work. And for today, we have a special pack that we've pulled together for you. This has been quite a long time coming, but finally, I think we have a good deal. We call it the African Philosophy Pack. Some of it is material that you may have heard about, and some of it is something that you're going to, at least one particular item is something that is very, very exclusive and very special, because it's, shall we say, a special gift from the publishers of a special book that we should be talking about in a few minutes. By the way, the book is titled Socrates and Orumila, Two Patron Saints of Classical Philosophy. But we'll come back to that in a minute. To give you a quick rundown of what the African Philosophy Pack, what it contains and what it means. Do you want to give us a quick check?
Well, the African Philosophy Pack is will be yours for your